Chapter 30. A barren waste of rock. While the Grand Canyon, its vast system of tributaries, and its plateau were being uplifted from the primeval ocean, it consisted of nothing but a wild, barren waste of rock. Not a tree, not a shrub, not a flower, not a blade of grass relieved the monotony of the wilderness of rocks which emerged from the great Eocene Sea. Not a lizard, horned toad, centipede, tarantula, chiquala, campomach, frog, tree toad, turtle or snake was to be found on the long stretching areas of its lifeless shores. Not a chipmunk, prairie dog, coyote, rat, mouse, porcupine, fox, bear, mountain lion, badger, deer, antelope or other four-footed creature ran over its newborn surfaces. The sun shone unhindered. The rain beat with pitiless fury. The wind swept unhampered. The snows piled up undeterred over the whole plateau and canyon country. It was plateau and canyon, canyon and plateau, red rock, gray rock, creamy rock, yellow, pink, blue, chocolate, carmine, crimson rock, soft rock, hard rock, sunshine, shadow, wind, and quietude. Winter, summer, autumn, spring, and that was all. A lifeless world, as yet unprepared for insect, reptile, beast, man, flower or tree. Perhaps a solitary seabird with strong pinion flew over it, and gazed into its lifeless depths with wonder, or a dove flew from some earlier and habitable land over this wonderful mass of rock, and returned to its nest and its mate. But no olive or other leaf was in its bill. An insect that looks like a tiny dried wisp of hay, well known in Arizona. And so the Yelland was born, and rested, while silence, sunshine and solitude brooded over it. Creation of soil and verdure. But in the course of ages, soil was created by the disintegration of the rocks by the weather and the atmosphere. Seeds were blown in from regions where flowers and plants bloomed, or were carried in by birds, and later distributed by the four-footed creatures. Then verdure sprang into life. The gentle grasses and flowers began to cover the slopes and level places where soil had gathered, and the trees came to sway, and swing in the breezes, and sing their songs of coming life to the hitherto barren rocks. Fossils of sea creatures. Yet they had not been altogether lifeless. Many of the rocks had known life, but it was not insect, reptile, bird, beast or man life. Neither did they know anything of grass, flower, shrub or tree life. In the faraway ages, when they were being deposited deep under the surface of the Eocene Sea, they saw vast monsters floating in the salty deep, and later, fishes of all sizes, and even great beds of waving sea moss and ferns floated back and forth, as the tides ebbed and flowed. And fishes and ferns, monsters and moss were occasionally caught in the flowing deposits of lime and sand and silt and clay, and were embedded in their mass. Thus imprisoned, their otherwise forgotten life and history is told to the ages of man, that were as yet unborn. Coming of man. But now the new life is coming. With verdure and animal life in existence, these hitherto uninhabitable regions became capable of sustaining human life. And the restless spirit of the human race, wherever and howsoever it originated, drove bands of men and women into this region. Who were they? What were they like? Whence did they come? How long did they stay? Whither did they go? Are questions one naturally asks in regard to these first discoverers and inhabitants. If I were to say do not know, I would be saying what every other thinking man is compelled to say. Yet there is pleasure in conjecture. Traces of ruins. Before looking at these conjectures, however, it is appropriate that we look first at what facts there are to justify them. Suppositions without any facts are mere fictions of the imagination, and this we are not indulging in. When in our day men began to explore the Grand Canyon and its numberless tributaries, a great number of indications of man's presence were found on the rim, on the fault lines or breaks in the sheer precipitous walls, on the plateaus and in the canyon beneath, in the shape of crude house ruins, lookout houses or forts, indifferent trails, cliff dwellings, hewn out water cisterns, missile pits, with countless pieces of broken pottery, arrowheads, stone axes, hammers, mortars, pestles, and even cemeteries, or places of cremation. Evidences of superior civilization. Major J. W. Powell, in his Journal of Explorations, writes that when he and his party reached the mouth of the Uinta River, they went up to the agency of the Indians of the same name. While visiting the Indians, and noting their fertile, irrigated farms, he found many evidences that his beautiful valley has been the home of a people of a higher grade of cultivation than the present Utes. On our way here yesterday, we discovered, in many places along the trail, fragments of pottery, and wandering about the little farms today I find the foundations of ancient houses, and milling stones that were not used by nomadic people, as they are too heavy to be transported by such tribes, and are deeply worn. The Indians, seeing that I am interested in these matters, take pains to show me several other places where these evidences remain, and tell me that they know nothing about the people who formerly dwelt here. They further tell me that up in the canyon the rocks are covered with pictures. Ancient dwellings. When Powell and his party reached the junction of the San Juan with the Colorado, they might have found a large number of ancient dwellings in the cliffs not far away from where Bluff City now stands. Further on, when the Bright Angel was discovered, the beautiful stream and canyon on the north side of the canyon directly opposite El Tovar, the story of which is told in a separate chapter, Major Powell went up a little gulch, just above Bright Angel Creek, about 200 yards from their camp on the Colorado, and there he discovered the ruins of two or three old houses, which were originally of stone, laid in mortar. Only the foundations were left, but irregular blocks, of which the houses were constructed, were found lying scattered about. In one room he found an old milling stone, deeply worn, as if it had been much used. A great deal of pottery was strewn around, and old trails, which in some places were deeply worn into the rocks, were seen. Ruins of a village. Between the foot of what is now the Bright Angel Trail and Bases Cable Crossing, Major Powell discovered another group of ruins. There was evidently quite a village on this rock. Again we find the milling stones, and much broken pottery, and up in a little natural shelf in the rock, back of the ruins, we find a globular basket that would hold perhaps a third of a bushel. It is badly broken, and, as I attempt to take it up, it falls to pieces. There are many beautiful flint chips, as if this had been the home of an old arrow maker. Old gardens. Later, when white men began to go down the trail now known as the Bright Angel Trail, the one near to El Tovar, the remnants of gardens, with irrigating ditches, in which small pieces of Indian pottery were scattered about, were discovered. The place is known today as Indian Garden, and is seen from the upper porch of the hotel. Stone huts. In his account of Powell's second expedition, D'Lenbaugh tells of ancient ruins found below Labyrinth Canyon. S. Small huts for storage were found there in the cliffs, and on a promontory, about 30 feet above the water, were the ruins of stone buildings, one of which, 12 by 20 feet in dimensions, had walls still standing about 6 feet high. The canyon here was some 600 feet high, though the top of the plateau through which the canyon is carved is at least 1500 feet above the river. We discovered the trail by which the old Pueblans had made their way in and out. Where necessity called for it, poles and tree trunks had been placed against the rocks to aid the climbers. Some of our party trusted themselves to these ancient ladders, and with the aid of a rope also, reached the summit. These Indians had tilled a small piece of arable land in an alcove nearby. An old Indian fortress. Hans found a number of cliff ruins, and the remnants of old houses on and near his trail, and on the Red Canyon Trail. It was the discovery of an old Indian lookout fortress, located on the very edge of the canyon, where base camp now is, that led base to hunt for the trail into the canyon. This fortress is about 15 feet square, outside measurement, and consists of one room, 12 feet square, with a lookout in the eastern wall, which is still to be seen. Remnants of the wall still stand, and at one corner are fully 10 feet high. About a mile below this fortress, were discovered two large native water storage tanks or reservoirs, which, when cleaned out, were capable of holding many hundreds of gallons of water. Further down, on the plateaus beneath, several large pits for the cooking of mesel were discovered. Cooking of mesel. This mesel is the succulent and sweet inner leaf of the agave desserti, which is found in large quantities in this region. The Indians still prepare it in the same manner as did their forefathers. The larger thick leaves are taken from the plants when they are full of sap. Great pits are dug and lined with rocks. Into these pits dry wood, roots, pine cones, etc., are thrown and set on fire until the whole oven is thoroughly heated. On the hot rocks are then laid the pulpy stalks of the agave. Over these is placed a layer of wet grass, then more agave or mesel leaves, more grass, and so on, until the pit is full. Then the oven and its contents are banked over with earth, and allowed to steam, and cook for 3 or 4 days. The woman in charge is an expert in determining when her reed is baked. She thrusts stalks of the agave into the heart of the pit before it is finally closed up, and when she deems I'm up, she pulls forth one of these stalks. If it is not done to her liking, she allows the process to continue. Otherwise the banked up earth is removed, and the contents of the pit withdrawn and placed upon adjacent rocks to dry. It now looks like large cakes of brownish fibers, thoroughly saturated in molasses. And tasted as sweet and fairly palatable, though the fibers render it a food that requires a large amount of mastication. It has great staying qualities, contains much nutrition, and will keep for months, even years. I have eaten pieces of it that were sweet and good over 3 years after it was made. Unlimited fragments of poetry. In my own wanderings of nearly 20 years in the Grand and Havasu Canyons and their smaller tributary gorges, I have discovered scores of these cliff dwellings. Ruins uncounted are to be found scattered along the rim, within 5 to 10 miles of the canyon, and thousands of pieces of pottery of old design have been picked up by the visitors of the past 15 years. On the Shinumo, opposite the base trail, are several cliff dwellings, and as late as the summer of 1908 a young couple camped there for a month on their wedding trip, excavated and discovered a fine stone axe, numbers of pieces of pottery of 3 different kinds, several pieces with holes bored with a primitive drill of flint or obsidian, a fine spearhead of flint, and a number of arrow points. Similarity of cliff ruins. The whole region of Arizona, New Mexico, southern Utah, and southern Colorado abounds in these cliff ruins. The likeness of their appearance, and the fact that everything excavated is of a similar kind, seems to indicate a relationship, both in time of occupancy and in the peoples who built and tenanted them. The questions now naturally arise. Who were these people? What was their life? Whence did they come? Whither have they gone? The race of the cliff dwellers. In the earlier days of America's serious researches into her own archaeology, those who led our thought on the subject, though personally they had not seen the cliff dwellings, declared them to be the homes of the Aztecs, one of the Mexican races found by courts below the city of Mexico. Hence today we find people talking about the Aztecs and their ruined homes in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah. We used to read of the wonder of the discoverers of these dwellings at finding them so small. The doorways were small, the rooms themselves less than 6 feet in width and length, and the ceilings so low that a 5-foot man could not stand upright in them. It was reasonable therefore to infer, said these discoverers, that the builders and inhabitants of the cliff dwellings were an exceedingly small people, dwarfs, as in no other way could the rooms be occupied. And thousands of people who have read about these ruins still hold to the idea that they were inhabited by dwarfs. But who the dwarfs were, or where they have gone to, no one seems to have the remotest idea. But by and by, such men as Bandelier, the Mendeloffs, Stevenson, Cushing, Fuchs, Hawke, Hodge, and Hewitt, began to investigate. They took the field and carefully explored hundreds of ruins. Then, some of them with a profound knowledge of the Spanish tongue, went through all the records and diaries of the old conquistadors, and the padres who accompanied them. They found out all that the early Spaniards had discovered and conjectured. In the meantime, they began to study the languages of the Indians of the regions nearest to the ruins, and question them, as to their myths, legends, and traditions bearing upon the ruins, and their researches speedily bore fruit. Storage houses. First of all, they classified their discoveries. Though scores of skeletons were found, there was not a single dwarf specimen among them. This seemed to be a death blow to the dwarf theory. Stone slabs were used as doors. Necessarily, these were comparatively small, since even though large slabs might have been found, they could not have been moved by the cliff dwellers, on account of their weight. This, in itself, accounted for the size of the doorways. It had long been noticed that these small dwellings were scattered profusely, where there were larger dwellings, and finally it became known that the small dwellings were not used for habitations at all. They were merely storage houses for corn and other edibles, farmed by the inhabitants of the larger dwellings. On one occasion, some years ago, I was exploring one of the side gorges of the Havasu. We had seen scores of the cliff dwellings, perched high in the walls of the canyons, until at length one particularly well-built, though exceedingly small structure attracted my attention. My guide was the most intelligent and communicative of the Havasupai Indians, and he immediately responded to my query by crying out, "Colon Mila Hawa! Mila Hawa!" Corn house. Further inquiry revealed the fact that all the small dwellings were but storage houses for corn and other foods. Textiles. Excavation brought forth delicate textiles in cotton and yucca fiber, well woven, and in a remarkable state of preservation, silent testimony to the dry climate, and the fact that the dwellings were so constructed that rain and snow were practically excluded. Basketry and pottery in large quantities were found, all showing ability in manufacture, also artistic skill, and the aesthetic conception in the form of the articles, and the designs portrayed upon them. Excavated relics. Stone hammers and axes, obsidian, flint and other arrowheads, spearheads, and knives, mortars, and pestles, metatesser meal grinders, obsidian and flint drills for making holes through stone or shell, bows and arrows, the bows of tough wood often brought from afar, and the arrows pointed with chipped flint or obsidian, deftly and securely tied to the shaft with tough and durable strings of sinews, shell beads, pipes, bone awls, punches, needles, etc. Semicolon stone fetishes in semblance of animals, the like of which were never seen on land or sea, ornaments of shell, turquoise and onyx, and even a kind of jade, sandals and mats of yucca fiber, and exquisitely delicate feather robes, these are some of the things that the excavators have found. Corn cobs, melon rinds and grass seeds may be added to the list. Old cemeteries. Then, most interesting of finds, a number of cemeteries were located, and these were raked and scraped over until every visible secret hidden in their depths was brought into the light of the sun. Tracing the Indian races. Now here were numbers of facts to work upon. Then the myths, legends, and traditions of the Indians living nearby were carefully collected and studied, and light began to dawn in the minds of our archaeologists. The Hoppus in northern Arizona, the Zunas in New Mexico, the Acomas who live on the massive cliff 20 miles south of the Santa Fe Railway at Laguna Station, the score of Pueblos on the banks of the Rio Grande, even to far away Taz, all contributed their share to the elucidation of the mystery. Even the semi-nomadic Navajo had something to say which helped. Cushing found among the Zuni stories galore of their struggles with the fierce and warlike wandering tribes, who constantly harassed the home-loving people who built their root villages. Fuchs not only unearthed whole cities of the past, but gained from the nearby Apis their traditions, which told in reasonable and intelligible form what was most probably their history. He listened while their old men and women recited the stories and legends of their migration from the south northwards, and how certain families or clans came from this or that direction, building and inhabiting certain now ruined dwellings in ages long past. Others heard similar stories, which they investigated as far as possible, compared with the ruins named, and then recorded, with such discovered facts as helped in the elucidation of the problems involved. Ancestors of the Pueblo people. All these investigations pointed to one great fact, and that was that the cliff and cave dwellers of the Grand Canyon region and all the contiguous country were none other than the ancestors of the present Pueblo people, those who live in the Hopi villages, the Zunai villages, Acoma, Laguna, Santo Domingo, Islita, Tessic, Gemas, Taz, San Ildefonso, Zaya and the rest. With this luminous fact before them, a greater study began of these Pueblo people, and it was then found that, to this day, they use the same utensils, make the same implements, wear the same ornaments, follow the same burial customs, and generally live the same life that these ancient cliff dwellers did. The conclusions, therefore, are obvious and inevitable. The cliff dwellers were none other than the ancestors of the Pueblo people, a little less advanced, doubtless, in the march of civilization, yet already far progressed from the root civilization of the nomad. They were driven to occupy the inaccessible cliffs by the constant attacks of the warlike nomads. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.